Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3am.
Powered by the Breastfeeding Friend.
For breastfeeding advice, available 24/7 on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.
Welcome to episode one of Crib Notes. I'm Rick, I'm a broadcaster and a dad-to-be.
And I'm Sarah, a new mum and paediatrician.
So over the next few weeks, we're going to be taking you through on the ride into parenthood, but from a medical perspective, with some of the most qualified professionals in their area on things like sleep, breastfeeding, development, and problems that might pop up with your baby.
So in this episode, we're joined by Kirsty Howe. She's a midwife and antenatal teacher at Bump and Baby. And we're going to be covering the first few hours with the baby, how you might feel, what the baby might look like, and common questions parents have with their new baby. We've picked Kirsty to join us because she's a new mum and a midwife at the top of her game. She's worked internationally and trains other midwives.
Disclaimer alert, right from the top. I actually don't like kids.
Except mine, Kels, honestly.
I do like yours, a little. But I am just about to have a baby girl.
Congratulations, and congratulations to anyone listening. I'm assuming you're about to have a baby, or you've recently had one.
As the weeks go by, this will be a guide for me as well as you, although listening to myself asking questions that I'd be asking anyway is a little bit weird. Do you think actually being a paediatrician made it easier having a baby?
I don't know. Yes and no. Overall, no, not really. I've had to learn all of the same things that other new mums have had to learn. It's completely different looking after unwell children in hospital than actually the reality of having your very own at home. I have a little girl called Daisy who's now 7 months old, and I'm still trying to figure things out. And I guess that's one of the points of this podcast. We're trying to reduce that mum guilt that everyone has. We know that there's not really one right way of doing things. There's so much pressure and judgment out there, and actually a lot of misinformation too. And it's easy to get caught up in all the hysteria. And you may hear a few yelps and screams in the background. Some of these episodes will have been recorded in my little one's nap, so you might hear a little extra guest every now and then.
So anyway, shall we get on with it?
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Kirsty, have you run 10K this morning?
I have indeed, yes.
Impressive.
I am running the New York Marathon in 4 weeks' time.
Oh, so gosh.
I snuck in a quick 10K this morning.
Oh, as you do?
Yeah.
Have you done any marathons before?
I have done London, so
amazing.
I've spectated New York a couple of times, but I've never run it, so I'm very excited to be running it.
So let's start off with talking about when your baby's first born then. It is a bit of a blur and a haze, isn't it?
Completely. Myself, I've had a baby last October. He's just turned one, and so I've been going through all those moments again, as he approached his first birthday. And I really can just remember that first moment. They hand you your baby and you expect to feel in a certain way, and it's completely different. It's a bit of panic, I guess.
You know, you have so many questions and you don't always feel that instant love that people tell you, do you? Sometimes that actually can grow, and that's completely normal.
Yeah, I remember primarily feeling relief because you have labour first,
yeah.
And during labour, you're expecting to just get through labour, and then this slippery baby's handed to you, and the relief is absolutely overwhelming. The love and everything else comes when it comes, but I just remember feeling a huge amount of relief and just clinging to the slippery little person that was on my chest.
And you often have, you know, 1,001 questions running over you, don't you? So is this normal? Should it look like that?
Yeah, exactly. I remember thinking, oh, are they going to cry? Because I really wanted to have him in the water, which I didn't in the end. But I had the opposite, where he would not stop crying. I had about an hour of him screaming at me, going, please stop crying. But all completely normal and terrifying. Despite being a midwife, it's amazing. But I just remember
real life-changing experience.
Yeah, really, really life-changing.
Because I heard, because sometimes they don't actually cry straight away, do they?
That's true. Most do, but actually, if you think about it, there's some incredible sort of physiological changes which happen. So if you think about the fetal circulation, where you get all the nutrients from the placenta through the mother. And then actually, when the baby's born, it's changing to the neonatal circulation. So it's only really when they're born, when they start using the lungs, so the gas exchange happens, and when the umbilical cord is cut, that all these various valves close, the baby then starts having neonatal circulation. You can quite understand why they don't all cry straight away.
Definitely when the babies are born in water as well, They obviously are in water inside and then they're delivered in water. And often they don't know they're born. So they come out and everybody's expecting them to cry, but they're just looking around and they're very calm. Mm. And yeah, no crying, but we're always perfectly happy that they're completely okay.
And have you got to tap them on the tummy sometimes to get them going?
Well, sometimes, you know, the good rub with an NHS towel, people think that we're being quite rough with them, but actually we're not. We're just stimulating them to help them clear all the fluid which is in their lungs, which then, you know, helps them cry. And people sometimes are a bit surprised because babies aren't born in one contraction. So when they first come through, it's their head. And then after that, another contraction, their shoulders and their body. So the baby can look quite lifeless to start with. But remember, they're still attached to that placenta in the fetal circulation. So that's fine. Mm. The baby is okay.
So what do babies actually look like when they come out? What they're covered in slime, aren't they?
Yeah, they can be covered in the mother's bodily fluids. They can be covered in, well, a little bit of blood and things like that. They can be
the mum's blood, that usually is, so don't worry too much.
Yeah, the mum's blood. They often have a substance called vernix on their skin. And they can have long hair as well, which is called lanugo. So, they don't look particularly like what we see in the movies, which is this fresh baby with perfect skin and
2.5 months old usually,
exactly, and really? Fluffy hair. Yeah. They don't look exactly like that, but they will get there. But at that point when they're born, they can, exactly like you said, they can be slimy.
Absolutely. I think some mums think, gosh, if I curse this child, you know, they've got this long haired pointy ears. So the baby's head can look quite funny shaped, really, particularly if they've had a forceps or an instrumental delivery. If you remember that actually the bones on the baby's head, it's very clever actually, they're not all fused, and that's because the baby needs to squeeze through the birth canal. And actually they have a little soft spot, a fontanelle as well, which is entirely normal. The baby can also look quite bluish initially, and that's obviously because the baby is not yet crying and getting all that oxygenated blood, but that very quickly settles as well.
And the baby's eyes can sometimes be a bit bloodshot as well, and that's because when the baby's being delivered, we don't want the head to come out in one go. We're trying to guide the baby's head out, so the head's inched out slowly, and of course the eyes are on the face, and that's going to be part of the area that's going to be slowly eased out. So during that process, you can get bloodshot eyes and also puffy eyes, so all completely normal.
The other thing is birthmarks as well. So many children have birthmarks when they're first born, whether that be a strawberry mark or a stalk mark, and sometimes a blue spot on the sacrum. And these are nothing to be too worried about. Point them out to the paediatrician when they're doing their baby check and they will be able to reassure you.
As the baby adapts to life outside, they change minute by minute, hour by hour, and they start looking a bit more earth-like and
like the dad.
Exactly. So often when mums first see these babies and they look at them and they're not looking exactly how they expected, they instantly say, oh, it looks like you. He's got your genes. I think that is a myth that babies do look like their dads, but they definitely change quite dramatically over those first few hours and especially those first few days.
And eye colour as well, it constantly changes, doesn't it?
Yeah, so actually up until, you don't fully know what colour a baby's eye is going to be, even potentially up to the year of age. They often, if they're a Caucasian baby, will have bluish eyes to start with or a slate colour. But we, you know, usually by about 3 to 6 months, you'll know what eye colour a baby will have.
The Crib Notes podcast is a co-production with The Breastfeeding Friend. It's available on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.
This skill has been loaded with loads of new amazing features and information, such as soothing sounds and relaxing music and lullabies for you and your baby during those exhausting night feeds. Plus, Crib Notes is on there too.
Kirsty, as a midwife, you obviously see so often the dad holding the hand of the mum as the baby's delivered. What would you say is kind of the most common reaction of the dad at the bedside?
Well, so I can talk from both perspectives. So a mum having a baby and my partner seeing the baby be born, and then also as a midwife. But considering we had done all the baby classes, I'm giving birth, the baby's coming out, and my midwives are actually my colleagues. And all of a sudden, my partner announces, there's a head, like something really unusual has just happened. And all three of us, despite being in the final stages of labour, just burst out laughing because he had no idea that that's what happens first, even though that's completely obvious that the head has to come first. So yeah, for some dads, there's shock horror as this baby, they know it's going to happen, but the actual intense moment and the reality of it happening, they don't know how to handle the situation. But as soon as the birth happens and then the baby's with the mum, going back to that relief, I think the dad just feels this huge relief for themselves and the dad and the mum and the baby. Because
And sometimes a dad can actually be more teary than the mum. The mum's just exhausted.
Exactly.
She just wants to have a bit of a relax. But the dad can be the one who's quite emotional.
Exactly. Because quite often the mums are in labour land. We're doing our job. We know we need to get this baby out. And the dad's overseeing the whole process. So for them, they've been on this journey. It's probably a bit different from our journey, but they've been on the journey as well. And knowing that the mum's safe, the baby's safe, and their little family's there is hugely emotional. It's really quite wonderful seeing the dads at delivery.
I'm sick of being asked, are you going to go down the business end? Would people stop asking me that question?
It sounds, I think, very strange before you're actually in the situation.
Yeah,
but actually
definitely.
Quite a few dads end up wanting to see. They've been sitting there for hours and hours and hours. And then they actually want to
and
know.
And it hugely depends on how the mum's delivering because as we see on the television and the movies, the business end is the end of the bed. That doesn't happen anymore. Mums want to be active. They want to move around. They might want to be in the pool. And all of a sudden, the business end is very much in full exposure for the dad. So although you might not want to look sometimes, which happens during my birth,
you might just
be there, and curiosity also might get the better
of
you.
Especially
when you start, if you've waited for a long time and then exciting things start happening, it's very difficult to not be drawn to seeing those first moments. So we'll ask you
we'll see.
The baby.
Ask me in a few weeks.
Exactly.
I want to talk about skin-to-skin contact. This is something that I'm constantly hearing now going through my classes as we build up to our due from date. Notice what I've done there. Skin-to-skin, so important, isn't it, Kirsty?
It's so important. The most relaxing thing we can do for them is, as soon as they're out of their comfy environment, is to put them straight on our skin, if everything else allows, and allow them to feel the warmth of your body, listen to the heartbeat that they've been listening to for the 9 months previously, listen to your voice, because they know your voice better than anybody else does because they hear it from the inside. And they want to smell you, and they'll be very soothed by the fact that they're getting such close contact, because they're used to living in a very, very small environment. So they absolutely love to be on your skin. But really don't worry if during delivery there's a reason why they need to take the baby away. They always try and allow the baby to go onto the skin. But if they really do need to take the baby away, then that time you can do the skin to skin up to a year old. Actually, my boy's over a year and he still loves, after he's had a bath, I dry him, pop him on my skin, and he absolutely loves it. So it's not something that only is in that first initial period. But if you can get it at that point, it's really calming for the baby and also for you. And it helps release the lovely hormone oxytocin. So the uterus.
Heard so much about that hormone.
Yeah, everybody loves oxytocin.
I've never heard about it before in my life before the last 9 months.
And now you know a lot of it. So obviously the oxytocin has helped stimulate the contractions and allow your uterus to contract to allow the baby to be born. And now it carries on contracting, which not everybody tells you. And that it needs to do that because the uterus is huge and it hasn't got the baby in anymore, so it needs to contract down to its normal size. So having the baby on your skin stimulates the love hormone oxytocin, and then your uterus can start contracting, and it can also tell your milk supply to get going,
because
there's a bit there's a baby there now.
The uterus is such a clever muscle, I found.
It's incredible, absolutely incredible.
Never knew anything about a uterus before a few months ago either. In fact, just a few weeks ago. Delayed cord clamping. This is something I've been learning quite a lot about. So if we went back a few years, when the baby comes out, obviously the cord's still attached. But if we went back a few years, baby would come out and they'd probably just snip the cord straight away. But now,
it's become common and kind of general practice now, hasn't it, Sarah, that they actually wait a while. And this is so,
yeah,
I've been listening in my classes, so the blood transfers from the placenta.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is something that we don't want mums and dads to worry too much about. It is routine practice. If for some reason they're not able to do this, don't stress too much. We were all born without delayed cord clamping and we were absolutely fine.
Wow.
There have been some studies which show that it can prevent anemia in a small selection of patients. It's probably more relevant if your baby was born premature, if you're in a low-income country. So yes, it's great if it can be done. It's no harm. It doesn't cost anything. But if it's not done, don't worry too much.
No, exactly right. The usual practice, if we can and everything was nice and low risk, is that the baby's on your chest and we allow the cord just to circulate that blood volume. So the way we know that there's
it's just
more
a few
blood.
Minutes.
Yeah, there's just a few minutes and the cord will have a pulse during that time. So once the pulse has stopped from the cord, that's when we know that then there's no longer any benefit from it. So that's when the cord can be clamped. Which, Rick, will you be clamping the cord?
No.
I might change my
mind. Really? Actually, I might change my mind on it, but at the moment, my instinct is not to. I just want anybody who's medically trained to do anything medical.
So you can't really do it too wrong.
Oh, I can do anything wrong.
I would agree with Sarah. As the midwife, we make it very easy for you.
Really?
We put two clamps on. We hold the scissors and place them in your hands and tell you exactly where to cut. And there is no nerve endings in the cord. Lots of dads think they're going to hurt the baby. There's no nerve endings in the cord. If it's a boy, we'll put our hand over the little boy's parts because then the dad is worried that he's going to cut the wrong part.
Yeah, this is why I might leave it to someone else.
So it is foolproof and it won't determine whether the baby has an innie or an outie. So it's completely up to you, but have it in the back of your mind and decide on the
day. It can feel quite gristly, but you know, they have some very good scissors. That
you two are just changing my mind about everything, you know, in the space of this podcast. What is the vitamin K injection? I've heard quite a lot about this.
So this is a common question. Vitamin K is a vitamin that we routinely give to all babies born in the UK unless parents are not happy for this to happen. This can be given via an injection or it can be given orally, and it prevents a condition called hemorrhagic disease of the newborn. Now, this is a very rare condition, but it is potentially fatal.
So what is that?
However, it's a bleeding disorder, so it can cause babies to have bleeding, for example, in their brain or from their umbilical cord, and it can be life-threatening. So it's not worth the risk, to be honest, but it is something that can be completely prevented by giving the vitamin K either via injection or orally. We recommend the injection because we know that it's all in one dose, and actually the baby doesn't even really notice compared to what's been going on the rest of that day,
being born,
it's not a big deal. They may not even cry. If the baby's feeding at the time, they won't even notice it compared to when they're having their new first baby grow put on, where they often do cry a little bit. They really don't notice. But the other option is that you can have it orally. That's now needed in three doses. And they do need a larger amount because we're not sure of the absorption in babies orally. And this has to be done over a number of weeks. And because it's quite a bitter taste, you do worry that babies spit a bit of it out.
Mm.
So you just have to be quite careful whether they've had the whole amount. And obviously, compared to having their lovely first feed with colostrum, babies don't necessarily like the taste. So in some ways, it could be kinder actually just having the quick injection it being done with.
Kirsty, do most people take the injection?
I have never seen a family not want the vitamin K. Some do offer want to have the oral medication, but I would say probably the majority would have the injection. And both Sarah and I have worked in hospitals around the world, and it's offered, the World Health Organization suggests every baby around the world has it. So we just see around the world that the children don't even, the parents don't get asked, the children just get given the injection. Mm. They don't have the oral option necessarily.
It's so widely used now that we know it's safe because so many babies have used it. There were some worries back in the 1990s. There was a scare that could there be a link with leukemia and the vitamin K injection? But they've done lots of studies since then with thousands and thousands more children, and they know now unequivocally it's completely safe. So we definitely think it's worth having. It's something that you should probably discuss with your health provider if you do have any concerns.
So after they've had the vitamin K injection, what happens next?
So, as soon as a baby's born, normally the dad straight away says, "How much does it weigh?" And I respond, "In fact, my eyes aren't scales. I don't actually know." So we like the baby to have skin to skin and to try and breastfeed and all these other things. So we do weigh the babies. We do top to tail checks. And at some point, the baby's nappy does go on. But they aren't priorities. But those things will happen and probably will be the next things to happen after the skin to skin and the feeding. So, yes, we'll do the injection and the weighing. They normally happen around the same time because that involves taking the baby away from the mum. We take the baby, we pop them on the scales, and we do the vitamin K injection. And we also use that as a time to do quite a quick top-to-toe check, because the babies do have a much more thorough one a bit later on. But we want to check things like their palate, that they haven't got any cleft palate, and that they've got a good suck, and just to check for birthmarks, check the genitalia. So we do a brief top-to-toe check whilst we're weighing the babies and giving them the vitamin K. And once that's all done, we give them back to mum or dad, because they don't necessarily need to be dressed at that point either. They can stay skin to skin for as long as you'd like.
So to get to this point, people now quite commonly come up with a birth plan, or as we're calling it, birth preferences. How common is that now? Do you just see that with most babies, or is this still something that's quite rare?
I would say, especially if people have done any kind of antenatal class, that it's something that they will have talked about. And they most probably will have talked about it with their midwife at an antenatal clinic appointment as well. More and more, like you say, it's being called preferences, because these babies have no idea what the plan is. So it's very unlikely that if we were to write a birth plan that the baby would follow this plan. So the preferences is a much better idea,
yeah,
because it's things that we can control. So as parents, if we would like the baby to come skin to skin, or we'd like the baby to breastfeed, or alternatively, we don't want the baby to breastfeed for whatever reason, then that's something that can go on the preference. So it's things that you can control. And if you've had the discussion with the dad, do you want to cut the cord, or do you have a phobia of blood and things like that, and you absolutely don't want to cut the cord?
Or do you want an epidural, and what pain relief options, things
exactly.
like that?
Exactly. So the things that you can control. And with pain relief, it's really useful just to have a think about it before. But more often than not, we find that when you're in labour, it's very different to what you're expecting, and you may change your mind. So when you think about pain relief options on your birth plan, again, exactly what we said before, just have an open mind and put what you think you would prefer to use, but also what other options you might be open to, just so that the midwives and doctors...
I think we're really lucky that in this country, birth is a safe thing to go through. Actually, there's many parts of the world where maternal mortality is still really high, and we see things like birth asphyxia. So I think if, for example, your ideal birth plan doesn't go as you would like, for example, you had to have an emergency C-section, fundamentally in 10 years' time, no one's going to know whether your baby came out of the sunroof or not. And it's more important to be present and be with the baby and think of it positively, and how lucky we are that everyone's safe.
Exactly. And our babies will not remember if they were born by cesarean or vaginally or by forceps or Ventouse. So they are going to be more than happy with how they've come out.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing. There's going to be no judgment from your baby as to how they were born. Just be flexible with your birth preferences, and you'll have a brilliant experience.
Not everyone, of course, is happy to see you in the hospital, though, are they, Sarah?
This is,
I mean, sometimes parents think, who invited the paediatrician?
I know, it's a shame, because obviously paediatricians, we love babies. We do go to lots of deliveries, but actually most of the time we're barely needed, are we? You know, you hear a baby crying and then we're off. And actually, parents sometimes worry, oh, having a paediatrician there, are they going to swoop in and take my baby away? But that's really not the case. Our priority is keeping mum and baby together. But if we are concerned, sometimes we do have to take a baby into the neonatal unit. You know, sometimes it is important to admit a baby for a little bit of extra help. We know this can be really stressful for mum, and the fathers can usually go with the baby, but we would only do this if there was genuinely some concern. And we really do just have to be cautious, because it's not worth taking any risks with babies. Mums can come and visit the babies as soon as they're ready. And I think one thing that's really key for parents to know is that we have an obligation to tell you what's going on with the baby. We're not going to hide anything from you. If your baby's looking really well, we'll tell you. And if we're needing to do more tests, we will also tell you. But sometimes it's a waiting game. Sometimes babies only need to be there for a couple of hours, but sometimes they need to be there a little bit longer. You know, we're incredibly lucky. There's an amazing team of nurses who will look after your baby whilst you're there. And so the baby will really get the best possible care. There's lots of things that we actually do in the neonatal unit as a precaution. So we might have to take certain blood tests. We might do, for example, a brain scan. This doesn't necessarily mean that we're worried about your baby's brain. It's just a routine thing that we do to be thorough.
So can we talk a little bit about the first hour though? People talk about it as a little window, don't they, Kirsty?
Yeah, so lots of times it's referred to as a protected hour or the golden hour. But as we talked about earlier, there's quite a lot of things that are going on once you've had your baby. So the baby, if everything has gone smoothly, the baby is currently on your skin. And it's getting lots of lovely blood left through the cord before the dad or somebody else cuts the cord. And then after that hour, other things need to happen because the mum has just had a baby. So 85% of women may need stitches. So
wow.
within this hour, that's quite a key thing as a midwife that we're trying to determine, because we don't want the mothers to be bleeding from an area that could be stitched up and that could stop the bleeding. So that's something that we want to try and do within the first hour. We also need to deliver your placenta, which will happen before the stitches or anything like that.
Yeah.
So this first hour actually goes really, really quickly because we've got the babies on the chests. They may be trying to breastfeed. There's a midwife trying to deliver a placenta. And then after that's delivered, we're trying to assess whether or not stitches are required. And if they are, we're trying to get everything ready to come and do that in a really sterile process. So that first hour is, yeah.
Goes so quickly.
Goes so quickly. And we try also to allow you to have a little bit of time alone with your baby. But as you can imagine, there's lots of things to do. So that's not always possible. But we do try and get lots of our roles done in that first hour, so that as soon as you've had your stitches, the mum, baby and dad can have some time together and potentially have a shower if the mum would like to.
The placenta is an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, not just by the fact that it's, you know, looking after the baby for while it's in the mum's womb, but it is just incredible what the world around the placenta and the businesses around placenta have become. At the end of my hypnobirthing class yesterday, I was given a leaflet that said, "We can encapsulate your placenta within 2 weeks and have them delivered to your door for £250. It's
bargain.
Bonkers. Is that cheap?
No, I'm only joking.
This has become such a hot topic recently, hasn't it? There's lots of people who are, I think, because of all of the celebrity endorsement, unfortunately, it's quite an unregulated area and people are taking advantage.
Really?
Yeah.
It's quite common though now, isn't it, that people do it?
It is. Well, I don't actually know how common it is, but you certainly hear a lot of noise about it. As you said, the placenta is an incredibly nutrient-dense organ. And so you can see why people came up with the idea that if you ate a placenta, that you might benefit in some way from this. Some people, for example, might eat it raw in a smoothie or have it dehydrated into pills. Afterwards, mums can feel quite lethargic, and there's all these claims that it can give you more energy, it can help bring your milk in, and even affect things like postnatal depression. But actually, when you look at the evidence, there's no evidence to support the claims. So some of the evidence is just anecdotal. So,
right.
For example, scientists going and speaking to mums and them saying how they felt. But that didn't have a placebo arm, so it may have just been down to chance. And actually, the only good, what we call randomised controlled trials in this area, where they gave placenta versus dehydrated beef, as a fake option, showed no changes in things like iron levels and no changes in mood, which basically means that it didn't work.
Yeah, I think I'll save the 250 quid.
And then there's also the health and safety issue. So I haven't got a problem with doing someone doing something if it's not harmful. But actually, as well as this placenta delivering nutrients, it also has a job of getting rid of toxins. So there's potentially toxin buildup in the placenta as well that you're potentially ingesting.
Do you see it all the time, Kirsty?
I wouldn't say all the time. I think, like Sarah said, there's a big celebrity endorsement surrounding placental encapsulation at the moment. But routinely, I don't think parents do opt for it. And that most probably is because of the lack of regulation, not knowing if it's being done in a laboratory or if it's being done in somebody's home. So it doesn't fill parents with confidence.
And you don't know it's your one that's coming back. You could have someone else's who've got hepatitis or HIV or whatever. And there have been case reports out there of people getting... So group B strep is a very serious infection for babies. And there was a case report of a baby getting group B strep after the mum had eaten placenta pills, where when they tested the pills, they actually saw that the group B strep was in there. So we do know that it's potentially a risk. So I think, to be honest, save your money and have a nice Wagyu steak.
yeah.
Because I think that's probably going to give you higher iron levels than eating your placenta, which, let's face it, they're not particularly attractive or nice smelling things, are they?
No, definitely not.
After the birth, how you feel is obviously exhausted, but you've been through so many emotions, haven't you?
And your hormones are going wild.
And you need to kind of prepare for that as well.
Exactly. I don't know about you, Sarah, but I can't remember much of those first
6 weeks.
Oh,
it was a complete haze.
Exactly. So you feel emotionally and physically exhausted. And I think that starts towards the end of pregnancy, really. You're carrying this large baby around and you're trying to do your day-to-day things, walking around. You're tired before you go into labour quite often. I can't talk for everybody, but that's personally
absolutely
how I felt.
Yeah.
And then you go into labour and then you have a newborn baby. So it's very hard for it not to be emotionally and physically exhausting. But also for the dads. The dads are going through this journey with us. And this is a really key point, actually, because we need the dads to not be tired and not be exhausted and not to tell us how tired they are. Because dads always say, oh my goodness, I'm exhausted. And you are allowed to feel it, but just don't tell us that you are.
Quiet voice.
A really important thing is that some hospital units will allow the dads to stay once the baby is born. But that's it's quite a good time for the dads to then get their rest back at home so that the mums and babies can be supported by the midwives and the student midwives and the support team. And then when you come back in the morning, you're fresh and you can be really, really useful and take the babies for some skin-to-skin whilst the mums get some rest.
Enjoy those newborn cuddles.
Yeah, what is an average kind of time that you might be in? I know it's different for everyone, but, you know, is it quite common that you stay the night?
I mean, you can have a 6-hour discharge, which...
It's very quick for the first
It's very
one.
Quick. If we've established that first hour, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. Those next 5 hours are also going to go really, really quickly. So if it's your first baby, we would really, really recommend staying in, especially if you want to be breastfeeding that baby, because that first night... You'll just have to press a button and somebody can come and help you. So
and take advantage of that, because although when you're home, there'll be the wonderful community team that will come and see you, it's just not on tap as available, is it? So whilst you're in hospital, try and get as many people to help you with that latch, because actually that support network is invaluable. I remember actually not really wanting to go straight home. I wanted to be in that little hospital protected bubble for as long as I could. But my husband was desperate for us to get home.
Yeah, exactly the same as us. We had a Cocker Spaniel at home. My other half was desperate to go and see the dog. But I had ordered an NHS meal. It was an all-day breakfast. And I did not know, I would never eat that normally. But it must have been the low energy and really needing that comfort food. And I would not leave the hospital until I'd eaten my all-day breakfast at 4 p.m. So often the hospital ward can feel really busy, really noisy. And you think, oh, I won't be able to get sleep here. But it also is quite nice hearing the other mums and babies and feeling part of the same process.
Because in other countries, they're in for a lot longer. And, you know, when our parents had us, they were in for weeks, weren't they?
Yeah, and it's a lovely time for you to see other parents, and your babies are exactly the same age, and it's so wonderful that you're all going through it together. So sometimes, although you want to rush home, there's a lot to be said for staying in, having some lovely free cups of NHS tea.
And toast. The wonderful toast.
And then going home in the morning. Once you've done a night at the hospital with some extra support to establish some good feeding.
Yeah. I think just take as much advantage as you can of getting to know the baby. I think ultimately you'll become an expert very quickly. I think lots of parents get very nervous about the fact that they don't know anything about babies. But actually, you'll start to discover everyone's winging it. And it's just about gaining some confidence and believing in yourself. That physical contact is so beneficial, as we talked about, to help bring that milk in.
And newborn babies smell phenomenal.
Oh, really?
They do.
So just smell their heads for as long as you can.
Absolutely delicious.
Absolutely, absolutely delicious, yeah.
Now, something we want to do on the podcast is cover myths in every single one. So, final thing, let's cover a few new baby myths. Can you spoil a baby?
You cannot spoil a baby. Babies absolutely love to be cuddled.
You can't spoil them. They're not being manipulative. They've just been in a very cramped little home and they've just been popped out. They need those cuddles to make themselves feel reassured.
Baby's stomach is only the size of a Malteser.
This is true. It's tiny. When they're first born on day one, they just need tiny amounts of colostrum.
When you're worried about, is the baby getting enough? If you imagine the size of a Malteser, how much milk would be needed to fill the inside of a Malteser? It's barely anything. So just little and often, and the first few days is all the baby needs.
And finally, babies have more bones than adults.
This is true. It sounds bizarre, doesn't it? But actually, a baby is born with around 300 bones. This is because they have more cartilage and then their bones begin to fuse, like we talked about the skull ones. And then when they're an adult, they'll have about 206 bones. So actually, they're born without kneecaps. They just have cartilage there instead.
Wow.
Bizarre.
So yeah, that's true.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3 a.m.
Powered by the Breastfeeding Friend.
For breastfeeding advice, available 24/7 on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.